My name's Ian Davis. I'm an autodidact. So I came into journalism by retraining after I was made redundant for about the umpteenth time. And I've been writing my blog, I think, for about 10 plus years. And I've been working professionally for about 5 or 6 years now. That's how I came into it.
Okay, but what made you make that leap? I mean, not everybody has the inclination to get into it. Difficult world, journalism. There's a lot of big mass media trying to push certain lines, and it's not the easiest world to thrive in. So why did you come to do it?
Well, I think I've always been interested in geopolitics and history. It's something that I've always written. I've always, since I was a child, I've written for fun, really. While I was working for the unions, I used to write, emails and contribute to sort of the unions kind of communications and stuff like that when I was working. I never really thought about doing it professionally when I was younger. But when I was made redundant again, I kind of thought, is there an opportunity for me to retrain and do this more full time? And I'd already started writing my blog purely out of interest. But you're absolutely right, Tony. There would be absolutely no chance of me being able to write the kind of things that and explore the topics that I do explore if I was reliant upon the mainstream media for any kind of employment. It's only the independent media that enables people like myself to be able to do what we do. Because these are topics and subjects which are not. I mean, I think it's fair to say now that the mainstream media is pretty much a single kind of cohesive propaganda machine. It's not what most people think it is. I would urge people, if they are, and I'm sure your listeners are aware of this, if they are seeking information that perhaps looks in subjects in a bit more depth and certainly the kind of stuff that I do, which is heavily reliant on referencing and citing the evidence that I put forward to support my arguments and support the points that I'm making, which the mainstream media does not do. Because I'm not asking, and I think this is an important difference between the independent media, the better independent media and the mainstream media, is that I'm not asking anyone to trust anything I say. I'm just simply asking them to look at the evidence that I am reporting and from that draw their own conclusions. Now, obviously, I've got a point of view and I've got an opinion, but I'm not demanding that people trust that opinion, which is precisely what, for example, outlets like the BBC do. And it's in their mission statement that the foundation of the BBC is trust. Well, trust means that you're trusting information without critically evaluating it. That's partly the definition of the word trust. So that's not enough, I don't think, especially at a time like we've got at the moment where propaganda is absolutely everywhere.
It is. And also, isn't it interesting the way that all these mainstream media outlets, pretty much without exception now, have got a sort of a little rider on the screen or at the BBC. It's things like BBC Verify, which explain why the viewers, why the listeners, why the readers can trust them.
Yeah. And I mean, that's very important for, most of us, if we meet someone in the street, or perhaps we're talking to someone, perhaps buying a car or something like that. If someone asks us to trust them, our kind of natural reaction to that is, well, sure, I'm willing to trust you if I've got reason to trust you. I don't trust you. I don't know you. That's a pretty normal human reaction. And yet somehow we are expected to trust information that is given to us by mainstream media sources. They expect that trust of us. They need that trust, because what they're basically asking is trust what we say and don't look at that information more closely and don't critically evaluate that information for yourself. just listen to what we say. Well, that's precisely how propaganda works. That is the basis of propaganda. Well, one of the basis, the other very major basis of propaganda is appeal to emotion, i.e. getting you to switch off your reasoning and think and emotionally react to information that's given to you. And I mean, for me, that was never enough. I mean, one of the reasons that I guess I do what I do now is that I was always suspicious of that kind of approach. So, I want to be able to critically think about the information that I'm given, and I reserve that right. And that's something which I encourage all of my readers, to do. I mean, look at the information I'm given and research it yourself if you have the time. And I do realize that not everybody has the time, and that's unfortunately the trap that a lot of people fall into.
A lot of people I think have been interested to see this spat with Zelensky on Friday in the Oval Office. It looked to me as if Zelensky had sort of been sent over there to kind of chastise Trump for not supporting the Ukraine war enough. Anyway, fascinating repercussions, and it took 4 days really for him to come out with a proper response, which does hint that maybe he's not really actually in charge of Ukraine, that he's more managing it for other people who have decided what his response is going to be. But anyway, you've pointed out in your latest article about the technate a very important aspect of Donald Trump, which is that he's got this coterie of tech giants, the new media barons, I suppose you could call them, sort of hovering around behind him. The people like Musk is kind of more obvious, but Peter Thiel. And I think most of us know who these people are. We use their products, but you don't know very much about what they think. So you've done this thing about the technate. Can you just explain some of the terms in the title? Because I don't think many people necessarily understand what technocracy is or the technate.
When most people talk about technocracy, they think of it in terms of technocratic governance, i.e. the kind of thing where we see people like Chris Whitty or Vance, leading what seem to be leading policy, experts leading policy. That is technocratic governance, but that isn't what technocracy is about. Technocracy is a system of, it's a socio-political system which sets efficiency at the heart of every decision and operates based on the notion that there are technological solutions to every kind of social problem. So technology is very much center stage in decision making, which of course now, when we're thinking about how AI is being deployed, that is exactly what we are seeing. But more than that, it's probably one of the most radical kind of totalitarian systems of control ever proposed, because it eradicates society as we know it. Society as we know it is gone in a technate. A technate is a continental system of control based upon the management of something called a sequence of functions. So every aspect of society, and they don't even use the word society, the technate does away with the word society and uses something called the social mechanism, because everything is mechanistic in their model of a technate. And they split society into a sequence of functions. So you might have the industrial sequence, the commercial, the financial sequence, this and so forth. These sequences are then managed by a continental control with about 100, which technocracy, when it was originally set up in the 1930s, suggested about 100 people. And from within the ranks of continental control, a continental director is selected, and they effectively run the entire continent, the technate. That person is like the CEO of a highly mechanistic technological management system that operates every single function of what we would call society, but what technocrats in the technocracy vein call a social mechanism.
We've heard about technocrats' governance within the European Union, for example, technocrat prime ministers being put in charge of places like Greece and Italy. the idea is that they are the experts there from companies like Goldman Sachs. So is that actually part of this idea of the technate? Because it does sound quite similar, the idea of having a sort of financial controller in charge of everything.
Yeah, that technocratic governance, which is what you're referring to, it's very much part of it. So, you know, you have the right experts are chosen to make the right decisions about the right areas of their expertise. So, you know, you would put, for example, in charge of fiscal policy, you might put sociologists and economists in charge of that. And that's another thing. Political policy, as we understand it, is not part of technocracy. It's a top-down hierarchical control structure. It's almost like if you imagine turning society into a computer program and running it along those lines. That is what technocracy attempted to do in the 1930s, which it wasn't possible, and now it is possible. So, you know, and that's why people like Elon Musk and are very much kind of promoting that idea, because it has become feasible, yeah, technologically speaking.
You get into some really interesting stuff to do with Musk's grandfather, which I think, I mean, there are various people have looked at this a bit in the past, but you've actually got photos of this Technocracy Inc. because his granddad was in Canada. He went over to Pretoria in South Africa because he thought that was actually a better environment for the far right than Canada was in World War II. So can you tell us a bit about him and why you think he's, you know, had some sort of influence on Musk and this idea today?
Well, yeah, so Joshua Haldeman was Musk's maternal grandfather. He was the kind of director for Technocracy, became something called Technocracy Inc., which was an outlawed organization in Canada and the US during the war, because of its kind of radical ideas, which were suspected, perhaps wrongly actually, but were suspected by you know, the US and Canadian and the Western allies as being communist. It was something other than that, but nonetheless it was a radical organization which was banned, and Joshua Haldeman was the Canadian director for Technocracy Inc. He was arrested for his involvement. He subsequently was convicted, but I think he received a suspended sentence. But then, as you rightly say, they emigrated to South Africa. And yeah, he was an avowedly racist kind of mindset. But I think we need to see that in the context of the day. That wasn't unusual for people like Haldeman in the day. Then he went over there and, his daughter, Maya, Musk's mother, she was very familiar with, Haldeman's ideas. I mean, she was deeply involved with the family. She would help the Haldeman family, her father, kind of send out his political pack, you know, leaflets and things like that. So she was very familiar with his ideas. When Musk left South Africa, the first place he went to was Saskatchewan, which was the Haldeman sort of family origin home, where he stayed on a farm. But I think his cousin's farm, which was, you know, part of the Haldeman side of the family. He's obviously very close to his mother, so he would have been very familiar with Haldeman's ideas about technocracy. But I think the most important and most notable thing about Musk is that he's openly stated that he wants a technocracy. So, you know, he knows what that means. Musk is fully aware of what technocracy really is. And as I say, you know, it is the most kind of authoritarian, dictatorial, kind of oppressive, totalitarian system you could possibly imagine. And, you know, he's aware of that. I mean, Musk was had a comical to and fro between himself and Jeff Bezos on what was then Twitter, saying, I'm looking forward to building, or I'm going to accelerate creation of the technocracy on Mars, to which Bezos replies, "Oh, count me in." So these sort of billionaire oligarchs quite clearly favour technocracy as a political, a socio-political control system.
Mm. So these tech giants, Ian, are in an interesting position, aren't they? In that we've now got farmers out protesting because they are worried. Well, it does look as if they'll have their land taken off them through having to pay this family farm tax. We've got the we've also got the care workers out this week protesting in central London. Last week, actually, I think it was because of the hike in national insurance on the care homes that are already financially on their knees, these privatised care homes. But these guys, they really seem to have managed to sort out a system where they pay virtually no tax at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty common across the entire kind of upper echelons of the kind of corporate hegemony, isn't it? Across, you know, I mean, that multinational corporations rarely pay a fair proportion of tax. They've got numerous vehicles, especially the beneficial owners of those multinational corporations don't. I mean, one of the great tricks, isn't it, is philanthropy. So if you set up a philanthropic foundation, you know, with money siphoned off from your profits from your corporation, then that's, you know, by definition, that's a tax-free venture. But when you then see, you know, you look at what the way that, you know, these, I mean, for example, Jeff Bezos, I mean, you know, his foundation, I mean, it spends billions on research and development and things like that. But, you know, it's a great grift, really, because it enables you to massively reduce your tax take and at the same time invest in the development of markets, which your own corporation is then going to benefit from. So, I mean, it's a pretty, straightforward grift, but I mean it seems to go unnoticed everywhere constantly. And I think the reason for that is, I mean, I, you know, something that I've spoken about and something you've alluded to already is that, you know, really you know, political leaders that we elect, and that's very much what the piece is about, aren't really making the decisions that that count. So you know, I mean, and we can certainly see that in the US with the Trump administration, certainly with regard to those, the people that are behind it, which are, you know, notably Thiel and Musk, which is what the piece centres on.
Yeah. Do you want to just take us through some of these characters? I think most people have got a bit of good idea, especially with you fleshing it out there about Musk's background, about these other characters like Bezos and Thiel and how they kind of fit together. Because, yeah, we can talk about their philosophy, but each one of them seems to have a sort of slice of the technate cake, if you will.
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at Thiel and Musk particularly have been instrumental in the investments that have enabled the development of AI. So and one of the things that Thiel talks about a lot is about monopoly. He spoke about it in his book, saying that the freedom that monopolies enjoy enables them to make better decisions than effectively governments, because they have this surplus of control, which enables them to make better decisions. So he's very much always advocated that government should be run like a corporation.
In Britain, we've had this mad situation where the old Monopolies and Mergers Commission, the Competition and Market Authority, the chairman of that was recently sacked and replaced by somebody from Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah, which is incredible when you think about it. And the same thing, funnily enough, has happened in the US, where Trump's one of the first things Trump did was try to sack the head of the they've got a commission looking into what they call antitrust in the US. Trump immediately, upon his appointment, tried to sack the head of that commission, and there's been a legal dispute, and I think currently the Supreme Court has found against Trump, but whether what will come from that, I don't know. But yeah, so you get exactly the same thing on both sides of the Atlantic at the same time, because you know, that is the nature of trying to establish centralized control over the political state in a kind of, it's got a sort of more authoritarian, and I would very much suggest technocratic, and something we'll go on to talk about, kind of GovCorp, kind of so corporate government kind of model, which is, you know, happening. It's not just in the West either, I would say. It's everywhere. So, you know, this is all happening at the same time, really. So, I mean, Thiel, depending on how you say it, he's instrumental in the development of using, for example, the conflict in Ukraine for the development of AI weapon systems, which he's worked in partnership with the Pentagon to do that. Feels Palantir, for example, has been also been very influential in the complete obliteration of Gaza, the genocide. And at the same time, he professes to be a Christian and a kind of a political or he sort of professes to be almost apolitical, but someone that wants to establish, you know, a system of corporate control as a form of government in the West. I mean, Palantir was seed funded by the CIA through InQtel, its investment arm. It took something called the Total Information Awareness Project, which was run by a guy called John Poindexter, which was exposed and therefore got into a little bit of hot water, because basically it was absolute total surveillance of every single US citizen and probably, you know, I mean, I think it's fair to say abroad as well. And Thiel formed a kind of monopoly, which he with Palantir, based on close working relationship with the CIA, that enabled Palantir to become the business that it is. Palantir subsequently then went and partnered with the Israeli government, using the AI that it had largely weapon system and technology that it had largely developed in Ukraine, you know, working alongside Musk's Starlink system as well, to you know, support the Israeli genocide of the Palestinians. So these people that are behind the Trump administration, I mean, one of the most ridiculous things to say about, you know, and we go back to the thing that he said in his first term, and, you know, which became a joke about draining the swamp. He's sure what we're seeing with the Trump administration is a change of guard, if you like. But it is absolutely infested with deep state, intelligence linked oligarchs. That's the nature of this Trump administration. So the idea that this Trump administration is somehow some sort of beacon for liberty is one of the most absurd and ridiculous things I think I've, you know, it's on a scale of you know, with the Skripal yarn. It's utterly ludicrous.
Okay,
but we're being sold this, and people have. And I think the really concerning thing is that it's evident from, you know, certainly from conversations that are being had, you know, on social media, that millions of people are buying into this notion that he's some sort of, that the Trump administration represents some sort of libertarian kind of movement.
Ian, they want to believe, everyone wants to believe that things might get a bit better, but they don't want to believe that they might get worse. Now, I think you're old enough to remember a bit of the Thatcher years and privatisation. We were promised, weren't we, in those days, that the tough regulation by government would make sure that these privatised industries, whether it's part of the infrastructure that's now owned by these private equity firms from all over the world, but now it seems that the government is giving up with the idea of even regulating these markets. It's talking about freeing up planning all over the country for companies to, if they can buy the land, they can build what they want on it. I mean, this does smell of finance corporate rule. It's not that the government actually just wants to step out of their way and let them get on with it, which has a bit of a whiff of corporatism, fascism about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I touch on in the piece is stakeholder capitalism. So this was an idea that was put forward by Klaus Schwab in the 1970s that basically corporations should be what he called trustees of society. Well, trustee has got a very specific legal meaning. It means someone that takes responsibility for the conduct of a trust, which would be, he's talking about that trust being us. the society that we live in. So that's a direct kind of attempt at corporate control of And it manifests through the ubiquitous public-private partnerships. So we see, you know, the essence of stakeholder capitalism in all these public-private partnerships that are everywhere. I mean, one of the things that I say to people is, when we often hear government spokespeople talk about their partners, that is what they're talking about there is the kind of hold of stakeholder capitalism has taken root in the West, and, you know, and in the East as well. And basically what it means, it's kind of, I mean, I've argued in the piece that it's an inversion of fascism. So if you consider the kind of 1930s Italian fascismo kind of notion of a kind of melding of the public and private state, in that model, in that fascist model, you know, ultimately it was the public state, the political state that had control. You know, it could intercede at any point, and the public, you know, private corporations prospered by working alongside the public state, the political state, as long as it delivered the political state's objectives. You know, everyone was happy. Well, obviously not everyone was happy, but that was the idea. You know what I mean? So. Stakeholder capitalism is an inversion of that. The closest thing we can call it in our kind of traditional view of different political models is fascism, because it is a complete merger of the public and the private state. But in stakeholder capitalism, the private stakeholders, the global corporations, have primacy through partnership working agreements. So it's almost like an inversion of fascism. So in stakeholder capitalism, it's the private sector that has the upper hand. And that, when we think about it, I mean, you know, one of the things, I mean, we look at COVID, look at the rollout of the jabs and the mRNA jabs, and the horrendous consequences that are being caused by that. And the trust, again, that people put into some of the most highly prosecuted corporations on earth. I mean, I think Pfizer's legal costs are, you know, many, many billions. You know, so these corporations are not, quote, trustworthy. So the idea that the same corporation should be in charge of political decision making, which is ultimately what stakeholder capitalism delivers, which has been accepted across the West as a kind of working model, you know, is deeply, deeply concerning, and something that we all need to be aware of and resist.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back to the 1930s, Nazi Germany, you had a situation with the big steel companies, Krupps and Thyssen, looking at wanting to massively increase production. They were just loving the idea of all their steel being used to make tanks for war, this sort of thing. And it's, you could argue, actually, because of the arrangements there were with the Nazi Party, where every ton of steel or whatever it was that was made, there was a donation of however many marks to the Nazi Party, that actually the Nazi Party was working for them. You know, and that Hitler was a kind of front man for creating this massive war machine. And in a similar way, you might look at Trump's America as the Teal and Musk and the techno giants behind Trump, you know, and Trump being their front man. I think it was Nick Curtis Yarvin, the accelerationist in the States, was saying that wouldn't it be nice if we could have Musk as a chief executive and Trump as a kind of front man? So this does maybe have echoes of the 30s.
Yeah, very much. I mean, you know, when we think that, you know, technocracy came from that era as well. But I mean, I would argue that Trump is a front man. And I mean, I would argue that many of our kind of leading political figures are front men and women. You know, so yeah, I mean, I don't put a lot of I don't think that Trump is particularly steering the ship. Certainly, if you look at one of the first things, I mean, you can look at other things like Project 2025, which was backed very much by the Oh, I can't remember the name of the foundation now. You know, but it's got, you know, the Koch brothers and those kind of people are backing this idea of Project 2025, which was, you know, talking about a kind of CEO-led kind of corporate government. And, you know, I think something like of the executive orders that that Trump announced when he first took office, something like, I think there were 23 executive orders that he made, and 17 of those had come directly from Project 2025, which was not even a, you know, it was aligned to the Republican Party, but it wasn't a Republican Party think tank. It was a kind of techno-populist think tank. So, you know, Trump didn't write those executive orders. I mean, you know, his announcement of his $500 billion investment in AI infrastructure. I mean, who does that benefit but the corporations that are owned and run, or, you know, are invested in and run by people like Thiel and Musk? They benefit from that. I mean, it's this.
Trying to understand Trump, right, and what he is, he might even be as simple as there are, you know, just a few red lines, like you must introduce cryptocurrency. Are you in favor of that? Yes, I am. You must back Israel. Are you in favor of backing Israel? Yes, I am. So with a few red lines before the campaign and the election, maybe, Ian, Trump actually, so long as he doesn't cross those lines, he really does believe that he's in charge.
Well, I think, I mean, I mean, I don't know the guy, but my personal assessment of Trump is that he's an egotist and a bit of a narcissist. So I'm sure that would appeal to him if you sort of, I'm sure it's quite easy to puff him up and make him think that he's in charge, you know, so I'm sure he's a useful guy in that kind of sense. I mean, you know.
As was Hitler,
yeah, yeah. I mean, does he believe that, for example, you know, he made this commitment to the electorate that he would be getting rid of central bank digital currency, or rather that he wouldn't allow central bank digital currency to go forward. And sure enough, one of his first executive orders was to do exactly that, to resounding applause of the electorate, of the American electorate, who didn't want central bank digital currency. In that same executive order, he just took the regulatory hands off the development of stable coins by companies like, you know, stable coins like that are backed by companies like Paxos, which is run by Peter Thiel. So, you know, stable coins are just as programmable, which is the worrying part, I guess, from our perspective about central bank digital currency, are just as programmable as CBDC. But, what Trump's done effectively is instead of your money being programmed by Jerome Powell, Jamie Dimon's going to program it. Now, I don't think that, I don't think that's a better option.
No, definitely not. Isn't it how they sell this stuff to the American public? And, you know, it does take a little bit to drill into. But you've drilled in a lot into the philosophy behind this with people like Nick Land and Yarvin. So do you want to say something about that? Because this isn't coming out of nowhere.
No. So back in the 1990s, there was a research unit in Warwick University called the Cybernetics Culture Research Unit that was run by this guy by Nick Land and another guy called Mark Fisher and a woman called Sadie Plant, although Sadie Plant's kind of distanced herself from it. And they were looking at this kind of notion of, you know, based on the idea of Schumpeter's creative destruction. So Schumpeter put forward this idea that it's inherent to capitalism is this constant cycle of destruction, which comes from, you know, the kind of forward innovation has this tendency to make one market redundant and create new markets. So, you know, for example, we might think of, you know, the horse-drawn carriage, for example, gets made redundant by the internal combustion engine. So that's, you know, that's a very simple analogy, but that's kind of what he's saying. with the notion of creative destruction. So what Schumpeter said was, you know, this can be, therefore, creative destruction is a good thing. You know, it's desirable. It's the way that capitalism moves forward. So Land and Fisher in particular took this idea of Schumpeter's creative destruction and looked at how that works in a modern technological age. And what they noted was, you know, with the advent, the constant kind of reiteration and advent of new kind of leaps forward in technological advancement, you know, for quantum computing, for example, they predicted that we would achieve this point where it would become self-sustaining, and that technology itself, and I think this is particularly applicable to AI, would accelerate beyond the point at which human society was able to adapt to it. And they called that point at which the technological advancement becomes self-perpetuating, the singularity. At that point, you know, human intervention cannot stop it. It is self-perpetuating, as I said. So what they argued for was that in order for society to be able to adapt to this, as capitalism had within it this inherent creative destruction mechanism, what needed to happen was that creative destruction should be used as a deliberate kind of schema, that it should be adopted as a way of moving forward, of what they said, accelerating capitalism, the creative destruction of capitalism, to stave off what they thought would be the apocalyptic singularity. So in essence, their starting point was, you know, almost from a kind of humanitarian perspective. They're trying to, you know, that's this, but that was just the starting point of their kind of thinking on the subject. Where they went from there is, you know, I mean, we started talking about technocracy. What came to be called the neo-reactionary movement, or the NRX, which Yarvin and Land are key to, it's the most inhuman kind of possible, you know, future that you could possibly imagine is drawn out by the neo-reactionary movement, which ironically also has quite strong, or claims to be quite strongly underpinned by Christian faith. But it's not any kind of Christianity that most of us would recognize, you know. So it's a bizarre mix of these kind of destruction of systems, destruction, creative destruction of economies, of, in order to rapidly advance to ensure that humanity is able to cope with the singularity, which is inevitable in their view. So that means handing over power and control in its entirety to people that are able to manage capitalism more effectively, which is the CEOs of corporations. So they envisage breaking the state apart. And without getting too deep into the weeds of how they do this, they're using a process called neo-cameralization to break the state apart into what they call sovereign corporations, or sovcors. So these sovcors would manage various aspects of what the technocrats called the social mechanism, and would then be overall the whole thing. And I think this is where there's a bit of a kind of departure between Yarvin and Land. Land suggests and has promoted the idea that the whole system, so now we're talking about the nation state, what we would call a nation state, should be managed by an overarching corporation called GovCorp. So that literally we would live in a society, if the neo-reactionaries ideas are adopted, we would live in a society that is run as a corporation, overseen by a private corporation called GovCorp. So that's what they're aiming at. And Peter Thiel is fully on board with this idea. Now, Peter Thiel is also very influential, I would suggest, in the Trump administration.
Yeah. Well, look, the whole point of this, it seems to me, is to act completely the obverse of democracy. Now, whatever system you want, the principle of democracy is the people are in the driving seat. We've seen, I mean, just here in Little Bristol, I've seen over the last decade or so, a complete transformation since all the coalition cuts. What we've seen is a kind of turning of the local city council into a facilitator for business, for big business, for development, and less and less public services, even, you know, breaking the law in not looking after special needs kids, which they're supposed to be. And if you actually talk to many of people in the administration, even the current Green administration, it's like you're talking to somebody who's either managing the collapse of a business, or, but certainly their attitude is, we're not going to tell anybody anything unless they squeeze it out of them. So we've got this kind of business mentality now, it just in our local city council.
Yeah. And I think we can look at cities across the UK and see the same thing happening. I mean, one of the great dangers that we're facing is, whilst many of us, perhaps with a more libertarian mindset, that might embrace the idea of decentralization, i.e., you know, like kind of bringing decision making down to a more local level, which is, you know, in essence, is a perhaps, you know, one of the beneficial aspects of the kind of progressive ideas. Yarvin Land, the neo-reactionaries, and the technocrats to a certain extent use concepts like decentralization to suggest that, you know, this is somehow beneficial for us. So we see the rise of the kind of regional authorities, of kind of this drive for, you know, my kind of more power invested in mayors. This kind of idea, which on its surface, people think, well, that's essentially democratic because that's better. We've got more local oversight. You know, that's good for us. And that's certainly the way it's pitched. But unfortunately, the people that are in control often in these, you know, regional authorities are beholden to a much wider and sometimes even global network. So if we think of the C40 City Mayors Network, which, for example, Sadiq Khan has the former chair of, actually, but, you know, part of, that is a globalist network that is driving forward global policy agendas. Now, so while people elect a local, in this case, let's take like London electing Sadiq Khan, they think they're electing a local representative who is going to be more representative of their views. Khan doesn't represent their views. Khan represents the C40 City Mayors Network's views. So what they're actually doing is, you know, if we think about the traditional kind of representative democratic model that we're supposed to exercise in the UK, is this notion of decentralisation, which people quite rightly welcome, is being flipped on its head, which is very common with the way this kind of stuff operates, to actually create a kind of centralised network of what Curtis Yarvin called realms. So Yarvin, in with the notion of the neo-reactionary kind of notion of what's something called the Dark Enlightenment and Land, they envisage what they call a network of realms. So CEOs of sovereign corporations would be in charge of their individual realms. Now, that's what we call a kind of decentralized, kind of local government model of kind of decentralized regional authority model. So that model itself, which is not a bad idea, I'm not arguing against that model, but I'm just saying that these things that we are being kind of coerced into believing in, unfortunately, are being exploited by people that couldn't have a more different perspective on governance. Their approach is utterly authoritarian, top down, centralized, control of everything that we do.
Well, look, you're reminding me a bit of Ayn Rand and her objectivism, which seemed to me to be very much the idea is let's create a philosophy that greedy people who want to get loads of money for themselves can just buy into. They don't really have to think. So long as they read Ayn Rand and they say, oh, yeah, we think Ayn Rand's pretty cool. And I think we've got a kind of similar thing going on today with people like Musk, Thiel, and this whole thing of the dark enlightenment. Because I see people like Musk, he likes throwing the word dark into his like little tweets here and there and just letting you know that there may be a dark side to all this. So what is this dark enlightenment? How does that fit in?
Yeah, so Land from the CCRU, he ended up, so Yarvin wrote as under a pseudonym as Mencius Moldberg, and he wrote a series of pieces sort of kind of expanding on this notion of creative destruction and what they call deterritorialization. And the idea being that every political system breaks down and then can be re-territorialized as something else. So Moldberg explored this. He came up with the soft core idea. He came up with the network of realms idea. Land built on that, and I think it was in 2012, published something called The Dark Enlightenment, where he advocated an overarching corporation called GovCorp. Now, within that, he said that the our sovereignty, so what we our concept of sovereignty now, they claim to be libertarians, but there is nothing libertarian about their approach. But anyway, so they said that sovereignty itself could be assessed and could be kind of mapped. So things like the lobby industry and, you know, the political funding and that kind of thing that is currently, we know, is one of the problems of that leads to corruption of the political system everywhere, that could be broken apart into what they call, by using a process they call neo-cameralization, could be broken apart into what they call fungible shares. So those fungible shares could then be distributed to the owners of the soft cores and gov core. So you would get rid, in their view, you would get rid of corruption because everything would be out in the open and there would be no politicians as such. There would be no politics as such. Everything would be run as a corporate governance structure. Now, in that, Land argued, because they believe in this thing called the singularity, because they believe that humanity is inevitably going to be unable to cope with that, is that we, the citizens, would be customers of GovCorp from which GovCorp would need to gather what they call rent, what we would call tax. So how are we going to function in this system when technology is at the state where they think it's heading? Well, the only option, according to Land, is to turn us into what he called technoplastic beings. So human cyborgs is what he means, where we would cross what he called the bionic horizon and would be fully programmable citizens, or as he called us, customers of GovCorp. We would have no means of redress. He suggested that what we would be able to do is make complaints using the complaint function of GovCorp. Now, I think we all know what it's like trying to make a complaint to any large corporation. But he's seriously, this is the Dark Enlightenment, he seriously argued that we would have no voice, but we'd have freedom of choice. So what he said was, you know, if you don't like it in your GovCorp system, which we call a country, if you don't like it, you just leave. Well, obviously, that's not a realistic prospect for billions of people around the world. So the idea is he thought that meant that GovCorps would compete to run the best possible country they could do. Government would be efficient because government would be, you know, this kind of service that is provided to the customers, and the whole point of government would be to attract more customers. the problem with Land and Yarvin and the whole neo-reactionary movement is that their appreciation and understanding of the motivations of oligarchs is ridiculously naive. They don't seem to grasp, well, it's difficult to say whether they grasp it and have chosen to ignore it, or whether they are that naive. They seem to think that if they break the state up into this kind of share structure, that it won't be the people that already own and run the state, i.e. the oligarchs, that won't buy it up. That how they've come to this conclusion is bizarre. And it is based upon, as I said, what I would consider to be a very naive, or maybe deliberately so, but what appears to be a very naive kind of conceptualization of how authoritarian power actually works. So they think that by converting it to some sort of management structure, you'll get rid of corruption, which is utterly absurd.
But that's what they're
dark enlightenment.
Getting towards the state where actually people are starting to become liabilities, and that particularly with increased technology, etc., and massive rents, people being driven into debt. I mean, we're seeing particularly now in the Middle East, whole vast, literally tens, hundreds of thousands of people who are surplus to requirements. And surely the logical conclusion of any kind of corporate state where the people don't really have a say apart from, your complaint system, is they're just going to get rid of those people. The idea is that they're a liability. Why would you want to keep them if you're GovCorp?
Exactly. And Thiel has quite openly written about this. I mean, Thiel refers to us as the unthinking demos. That's his view of us. That we're these kind of, we're just kind of this moronic herd of unthinking idiots that just need to be kind of weeded out. Not very intelligent proles. Yarvin argued for a more humane form of genocide, which he thinks, because genocide, I mean, seriously, Yarvin, the problem as Yarvin saw it with genocide is that it's a little bit kind of, it's bad PR, really. It's not good for you to kind of advocate genocide. So he wanted to find a more humane method of genocide, which he said that we could be like, once we become technoplastic beings, we can be kind of encapsulated like bees inside a cell within virtual reality. That will, more or less have the same kind of effect as killing us all. So we can be literally, they're envisaging something like, I don't know whether you've seen it, but kind of the sequence in The Matrix where the guy wakes up and realizes he's in a virtual reality, not in reality. He's actually in a kind of cell and a kind of hive. That's how they view us. So when we think that people like Thiel, for example, thinks we're the unthinking demos, and he doesn't just mean Americans. He means all of us, all of us. Humanity is what he means, because he's not one of us. He considers himself to be Odysseus. He's the great navigator of the world. So he works, his company, as we said, worked with the Israelis, to work on AI weapon systems that they've used to commit real genocide. So that's who these people are.
Yeah. Well, also, you remind me of the Nazi labor camps and the suggestion going around that actually maybe a more humane way to dispose of Jews and other unlikables, the Slavs, etc., was to just gas them. So this is sort of rather similar to this attitude. Look, I mean, Nick Land particularly, I know, was really into psychedelic drugs. Very, very, literally obsessed with them. At Sussex University, taking them every day. And I wonder if this isn't like Nazis on acid, Ian.
Yeah, no, it's... It is. I mean, one of the things, one of the points that's raised to me is something that a response that came when I wrote something in the piece is that, you know, that the American voters thought that they were kind of getting away from this kind of censorship and control of, but they're actually heading towards something worse. Now, someone picked me up on that and said, worse? How could it possibly be worse? And I said, if you read that, you know, I failed to convey to you the horror of technocracy and GovCorp and, you know, the neo-reactionary movement. It, you know, if we consider the atrocities that were committed by the Nazis during the war, you know, they were using the, you know, I think it's fair to say they were using the technology of the day. You know, so the technology, they turned that to the max and used that to try and exterminate entire races. Now, Yarvin, Land, Thiel, Musk, you know, they're using the technology of the day, not merely to kind of lead us into this unbelievable dystopia that they've got mapped out, but to control us along every step of the way. So it's not just about exterminating humanity and, I mean, literally exterminating humanity. I mean, that's what Land argues for. His solution is to turn us into something else, i.e. end humanity. That's his solution. So it is alarming, to say the least, that we've got people like Thiel in such prominent positions of influence that are on board with this stuff. Absolutely on board with it. They advocate it. So I, you know, the reason that I've written the piece and the reason that I'm very thankful that Whitney Webb at Unlimited Hangout has published it is that, you know, she agrees with me that we really, people need to know about this. They need to know what these people are thinking. Because it's like, you know, obviously Hitler won an election. I mean, I know there are very complex reasons for why he won. But I mean, it had people known what they were agreeing to, would they have carried on, you know, supporting the Nazi party? I mean, it's much more complex in Germany in the 1930s. So I realize that's probably a bad example. But I mean, I think people need to know what they are choosing to follow, because
the Nazi powers of surveillance and profiling, which were used to inter people throughout Europe and occupy Europe in the 1940s, were pretty tame actually compared to the surveillance state of today, and they were these IBM Hollerith machines. Edwin Black, I think it was, wrote the book IBM and the Holocaust, where he explains how IBM were hiring these machines out to the Nazi party right the way through the war, that they could use punch cards to literally say, right, we want to round up all the Jews in Dresden today and send the SS out to do it. And the first thing they did was press the little button on their IBM machine to tell them where all their addresses were that they needed to go to arrest these people. You know, we're now looking at a situation of mass surveillance, total information awareness, data theft, data mining, profiling of the whole of humanity virtually in computer systems. I'm not sure things like the Data Protection Act are really going to be able to protect us.
Well, I mean, ultimately where this stuff leads is the total, it negates the need for political policy. Because if you have something like programmable money, if you have the Internet of Things, the Internet of Bodies, if you have all this kind of centralized AI managed control over every aspect of our lives, political decision making is neither here nor there. It, you know, it doesn't need to be, there doesn't need to be a policy to, for example, stop you wandering out of your 15-minute city. That's not necessary. You can just program the money so it doesn't work outside of your 15-minute city. So, you know, we are heading to a place where, I mean, and ultimately that is precisely what the Dark Enlightenment, proposes, is complete control and technocracy. I mean, I think the way to look at it, and one of the ways that I've tried to present it in the piece, is that, that if you think that the Dark Enlightenment, this idea of GovCorp, this idea of total corporate control, is the underlying kind of philosophy that certainly is at the heart of the Trump administration, then technocracy, the creation of a technate, is it that offers the mechanism by which you will achieve it. So you know, sure, technocracy is a socio-political ideology, but it also is an operating system for a GovCorp. So these two ideas.
It's so important that people understand what's going on under the surface. Your piece, The Dark MAGA GovCorp Technate, you tantalizingly say this is part one. I couldn't quite believe that when I finished reading. I thought, hang on, did he say part one? Is it really just part one, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's part one, yeah. So in part two, you know, because because obviously it's a very long essay, and it's one of two long essays. And, you know, I mean, and I understand a lot of people have kind of like read it and thought, wow, this is deep weed stuff. But the point is, it's set up for part two because, and I urge people to read both. I think part two will be published in a couple of weeks' time, I think. You know, a lot of the context of part two, you won't understand it unless you've read part one. So in part two, I illustrate, hopefully, to the reader, how the ideas that have been expressed in part one are being implemented. I show how, you know, things like the DOGE in the US, the Department of Government Efficiency. Its decision making thus far is, you know, it has been described by some commentators as post-human, because the DOGE is already suggesting using AI to evaluate the efficiency of government workers and automatically fire them based on AI algorithms. Now, that is exactly what technocracy combined with the Dark Enlightenment is, the kind of society that's where it would lead to. That's exactly what it would lead to. And it's already happening.
Yeah. You also point out the DOGE is not necessarily a coincidental word to use, is it? Or acronym?
No. So the DOGE was the title given to the administrator of the mercantile Venetian Republic, which, if people, you know more about kind of that kind of history of how Venice was kind of the financial capital of the kind of world, and how most governments were in hock to the Venetian bankers, you know. So anyway, but yeah, certainly I think one of the things that I've tried to point out in the piece as well is this kind of constant use of kind of Aesopian language where, you know, so you often hear Musk, for example, talk about creating lives of abundance. We're going to have lives of abundance. You know, this term is often thrown around by people like Musk. Well, that is a direct quote from Technocracy Inc. study course, which is what the technocrats kind of published their kind of blueprint for a technate. So this is kind of signaling to people, other people that aren't aware perhaps of this, the kind of meaning of this stuff. Yeah, where they're heading. And I think calling the Department of Government Efficiency the DOGE is a pretty big kind of nod and a wink
It's an in-joke, isn't it? It's an in-joke.
It's an in-joke, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, because as I'm sure you know, I did go to school with Nick Land, and I went to, when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, 14, 15, was around his house all the time. And his father, at least I was told, his dad said he was director of Shell in South Africa. So there seems to be a bit of a South African connection with much of this stuff. Potentially, maybe there were connections between these families back there. And it was an absolute hellhole. I would really like to, if people haven't seen it, to watch the documentary about Saimar, which was this private far white extremist army. And the documentary is called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, came out in 2019, made by the Swedish state broadcasters, which takes you through the far right extremist private armies down there. And this particular one, which was injecting blacks with AIDS, saying it was a vaccine, this sort of thing. And it's an incredible insight into the far right in South Africa that were thankfully removed when with black majority rule. But look, I was hoping when you talked about part two, Ian, you said that you might be able to come up with some ideas, some solutions about what we can do about this. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I have, and I do. I mean, you know, I mean, the pieces are that, you know, I very much concentrate on the problems that are inherent to these ideas and how they're being implemented. But I do end the piece by saying that we don't have to accept any of this. These whole systems only work while we comply with them. In fact, very much the basis, the necessity of the systems from a kind of the oligarch perspective is that they enable them to control us. So because that matters to them, they need to control us. So there are many things that we can do, look into our own kind of, we spoke earlier about decentralization. So we can use decentralization, but we can use it in a positive way that is useful for us. So, you know, if we kind of localize our own kind of supply chains, you know, we kind of work with each other to support each other in our own communities. We develop our own systems of exchange. We develop our own kind of maximize our independence from the grid, for example. Now, I know, you know, for people that are living in, for example, the heart of Bristol, it's not easy for you to kind of grow your own food or be energy independent and that kind of thing. I realize that's an extremely difficult thing to do if you're living in a flat in Hartcliffe. But that doesn't mean that we can't make individual decisions that are based on a knowledge and awareness of what these people are trying to do to us. So, you know, we can refuse not to use anything, you know, or insist on using nothing but cash. We can insist that, you know, we won't divulge any information unless it's absolutely necessary for us to do so. You know, we can refuse to go to places that are using facial recognition scanning as they are rolled out. You know, we have the power. It's our wallets. That's the power that we've got. You know, there is something to be said for the power of the wallet. So, you know, there's no reason why we have to accept any of this. And my great hope in writing these pieces, and in fact, in, you know, pretty much everything I write, is that it's sure I'm talking about some pretty horrific and dark stuff. But the reason that I do so is because I think people need to know about it in order that they don't go along with it. Because the problem is, you know, we can certainly see this with the Trump administration. People are waving flags and thinking, oh, it's fantastic that Trump is going to bring peace to Ukraine. You know, and sure, ending that conflict, of course, that is absolutely essential for the most notably for the people of Ukraine and the people that live in Kursk, the Russians that live in Kursk, you know, and that live in the new, you know, the new independent territories or the new Russian territories as well. So it's vital for them and for the rest of the world, that we don't spiral down to World War III. But Trump, you know, intervening in the way that he has, which if you look at it closely, I mean, his promise of finding all these rare earth metals in the Donbass or in Ukraine is pretty dubious. But anyway, you know, what that's leading to is what? It's leading to a polarization with Europe, for example, which is leading to an 800 billion euro rearmament program. Mm. So is that leading us closer to peace? I think it's a bit premature to think that it is.
Well, let's see how the European leaders get along with that. Meloni's obviously put a bit of a spanner in the works as well, but whether it's actually going to be feasible to do it. I don't know. You know, these politicians seem to be disconnecting with reality a bit. It's interesting you talking about, you know, kind of having to apologize a bit for getting into these dark areas. I can remember reading a biography of Dennis Wheatley, the occult writer, who was accused quite a lot of encouraging people to get into Satanism, witchcraft, whatever, these kinds of things. And he said, no, I just want people to understand what's going on. And he always wrote from a much more a moral perspective, warning people about all this. And I always remember in one of his novels, him talking about Hitler as actually a prototype for an antichrist, a kind of figure in the future that would try to dominate planet Earth and get a right royal kicking for their trouble. But, you know, him talking about that. So there is most definitely an important mission to look into these dark places, to shine a light in there. And I wonder if maybe we could just finish with your thoughts on the farmers, because, I mean, I look around and history of 4,000 years of history where we've had surpluses from the land to make sure that people can kind of do stuff in the cities and in the towns, and we can have a prospering form of civilization through food surpluses, whereas this inheritance tax on the farms doesn't fall on corporations, does it? I mean, any of these different corporate forms of owning land will have to pay no tax, whereas individuals will.
Yeah, the source of what we would call modern civilization is farming. It was only when we started farming that we were able to devote any time to anything else. I mean, it's the absolute fundamental, most important part, probably, of any society that we've constructed over the last 5,000 years. So this is just a corporate control land grab of you know, farms in the UK, and it's not just happening in the UK either, is it? It's happening all across Europe. It's happening in the States. It's happening everywhere. New Zealand, yeah. So the idea is that you take everything away that enables people to be independent. I mean, what could be much more fundamental than the food? You know, if once people like Bill Gates have got control of the food supply, then, you know, in terms of being able to control populaces, that is an acute control lever over populations. So yeah, I mean, you know, and the idea, I mean, one of the, you know, the some of the most moronic arguments about, you know, the inheritance tax situation with the farmers, unfortunately, you know, we see more and more come from what we might in the UK consider to be the traditional left. You know, why shouldn't they pay inheritance tax, you know, banded about? What makes the farmers special? But of course, this is not a tax on their incomes. This is a tax on their assets from which they earn a relatively comparatively small income, which they won't be able to sustain once this, you know, proceeds. So, you know, we should be 100% behind the farmers, even if you live in the middle of a city and don't know where milk comes from. You know, it's couldn't be more important.
Have you got social media and stuff that you'd like to share with listeners?
Oh, yeah. You can find me on, sadly, you can find me on X. It's underscore in this together. You can find me on my Substack, which is iandavis.substack.com. And my blog, which is iandavis.com. And my name is the Scottish spelling of Ian, I-A-I-N, davis.com, all one word. And you can also, obviously, please read the articles on Unlimited Hangout. Also, I write for Geopolitics and Empire, and my work is also often republished by The Off Guardian. And I would urge people to support all of these independent media outlets, because they're really important going forward, because obviously there's a draconian censorship program goes along with all of this stuff. So that's where you can find me.
Look forward to part two of your piece, Ian, title of which is The Dark Magga Gov Corp Technate on Unlimited Hangout. Thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks very much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.